My name is Indrek Hilpers. I'm commonly known as Ian, but at the BBC I was known as Indrek. I was working in Bradford, just finished a college course in textiles. And at that time, it was 1972, 1973, when we were joining the common market, as Ted Heath called it, and all the mills started to shut down. There were wholesale redundancies, whereas prior to that, we were importing a lot of people from Bangladesh to fill up a labour shortage. Bradford was well known for textiles, particularly woolens and worsteds. And the same was beginning to happen all over the place. So I thought, well, industry's going downhill. The vacancy boards at no vacancies, whereas one time you could go walk out of one job and walk into another. So anyway, I thought I'd look in the paper and look for something else to do. And I saw something that really excited me, and that was selling insurance to students. This was a company based in Manchester called Student Insurance Services. And I applied for the job, got it, and then was assigned a team leader. And we all piled into a car, and we were going from university to university, knocking on students' residences' door, particularly targeting freshers. And it was quite fun. Little did we know it, we were being conned, and the actual product we were selling was a con. The insurance we were selling was whole-of-life equity and law policies, with, together with some term assurance, promising them a bright future. They needed no medical evidence in the future, and that they could use it to buy a house, for example, you know, the term insurance guaranteeing their health, and the whole of life policy would yield a profit, and it would become an endowment mortgage, and we had all the sales spiel to spiel it. And we were selling because the freshers had loads of money in the bank. There was no student loans then. They had grants, and they'd just been paid for the first time in their lives. They had new bank accounts, and they had hundreds of pounds. And to them, you know, to sign up a standing order, they didn't think about it, and they didn't analyse it. When I started to get suspicious, I phoned up one of my father's friends who worked in London for Liverpool Victoria Insurance, which is now LV. And he told me the ins and outs of the insurance, the whole of life policy and so on, and said it was a complete waste. If students wanted to buy insurance, they should go to Ensley, which is a company specialising in students and often had offices on campuses. So I thought, okay, I've been conned. I got in touch with the Sunday People and other newspapers and wrote letters of complaint in longhand, no internet then. And Julia got a phone call from Sunday People, and they did a double page spread and took some snatch photographs of the perpetrators. And that sort of the end of them, or I thought. Consequently, I also thought, I'll write to That's Life, Esther Anson. Esther Anson had recently taken over from Bernard Braden, and it seemed to be a very popular programme. And I thought, if I can get this information out there, I'll do it. So I rang them, and I got a call back from a researcher. We had a long conversation. Subsequently, I said, look, I'll come down to London. I wasn't working at the time. I had a few little savings, but enough for a few train fares. And so I came down to my old man's friend, who was living alone. He's recently been widowed in Clapham. And I stayed there, and I met the BBC That's Life team a few times. And when it came to, I came back up to Bradford, and I came down for transmission. The the recording of That's Life was done a couple of hours before transmission. So in other words, we would be recording it at 7:30, and it would go out at about 9:30 or so. So Saturdays initially, and then it, to Sunday nights. And it was very, very popular. I got to know Esther, I got to know Desmond Wilcox, who became her husband, and all the team, Glingworth, Nip, Karen, Plenderville, and so on. And then later on, the presenters changed. And I got on very well with Cyril Fletcher, who was also extremely popular. So they transmitted the story, and I went, was invited to the green room afterwards at TC Television Centre. And I said to Henry Murray, who was researcher and then producer, I said, look, I'd love to do that. I'd love to work in television. And lo and behold, I went back to my pretend uncle, my dad's army friend, and the phone rang on Monday morning, and Henry Murray said, would you like a couple of weeks' work? And I said, sure. So I went in, got the details, not all of them, but I got the details to be recruited for a company called Orthopaedic Bedding Centre, based in Bow in East London. Now, I'm new to London, and I found it difficult finding my way around, and I realised how expensive it was. So I got expenses, which I had to pick up from Cavendish Square. And I went undercover, did the story for Orthopaedic Bedding Services. And the funny thing was, they were sensitive to undercover reporters. And they accused several people in the room of around 20 people who were going through the training course on how to doorstep people from adverts and selling these beds. So I thought, I've got to watch myself here. Anyway, we were there taking this training. They accused somebody of being from News of the World, but they never suspected me. And I realised why. Because I was genuinely out of work and hungry for an income. And so I was a typical one, whereas the one that they accused of being a News of the World, who wasn't, he was educated, sounded, spoke with an accent, a middle-class accent, and spoke eloquently. So they targeted him. But I got away with it. I did the two works. The story got transmitted. We did have a confrontation where we piled into a large car and we confronted them prior to transmission. So I was sitting with Esther and so on. And then I had to expose myself who I really was. And the look on their faces was a picture. Well, I didn't know that they'd been exposed before and there were criminal charges. Because the finance they were using was a company called Coach House. And they were appearing at Chelmsford Crown Court. And I was asked by the editor, did I have any interest in photography? And I said, yeah, of course I can handle a camera. So they dispatched me to take a snapshot of people in court for Coach House Finance who were ripping customers buying orthopaedic beds. It was quite an unusual thing for me, so I was just winging it. The BBC directed me to, on account, hire equipment from Pelling and Cross in Baker Street. I gave me enough money and expenses to get a minicab, and it was hired to crouch down outside Chelmsford Crown Court, after I'd been in to identify who was going to be taking photographs of. I had a motor drive, I was in the back of a mini car, very bemused guy, and I just went click, 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 and got the two guys and took them to the guy who refused to take any more photographs because he had been attacked alongside Norma Shepherd. So he did the film processing, but refused to take photographs. I had to drop the film off, rehearsal film for TV, at his studio in Kilburn. And sure enough, the photographs came out beautifully. They did the story on the orthopedic bedding centre. But before the transmission, another researcher and I researched how these beds were made, and I found that they weren't really orthopedic beds at all. They were standard sprung beds that were made north of Brick Lane. And so I found them, went there, spoke to them. They didn't upholster the beds or label them. They just said, oh, we get the orders for single mattresses, and then they stitch them together. So you've got soft, medium, or hard, standard gauge mattresses. And I learned a lot about how beds were made. And then as a contrast to that, the researcher and I went to Heels in Tottenham Court Road to see a proper craftsman and how they made beds. So we were thorough. And there was no legal challenge, and the editors in the legal department said that my research was sound, and it was transmitted. And then the advert was in the bottom right of the Evening Standard on the front page, and people were just, you know, flocking, and the sales teams are going out. We found before transmission, we found a dissatisfied customer, and they said, this isn't really working. So we took an upholsterer with us, and we unpicked it, and we found that it had a medium spring, and another one was a hard spring, using just a simple micrometer. So I said to Henry Murray in the green room, I said, look, this is great. And he said, yeah, great, and I got paid well for it. And he said, we've got another story for you. And that's how it went on for many years. During the recording season, in other words, we were based at Lime Grove at that time. And
it was an enormous program, wasn't it? The ratings were extremely high here.
Yeah, 20 million. Desmond used to come in on a Monday morning. I didn't have my own desk. I was out in the field. If anybody was out, I'd use their desk for the desk part of it. And we had a separate phone line that we could make anonymous phone calls from, so it wasn't a BBC line. And, it was push, and I was getting out stories. 20 million. Desmond would walk in and he'd say, well done, everybody. We were number one today in the ratings, 20 million. And we were vying with Coronation Street. I mean, it was hugely popular. What about
the staff? Can you just tell us a bit about Wilcox and also about the... Wasn't there a bit of movement between the Jimmy Savile, Jim Will Fix It and That's Life in terms of staff?
Yeah, the staff members who were PAY employed were employed, and they'll move from programme to programme. And so they would apply and say, well, I've been working on Last Life, let's do Jim Will Fix It or do something else. This was in General Features. Desmond Wilcox was the boss, and obviously I was with on Last Life. And then strangely enough, Esther, after a few couple of years and several stories in between series, because I was freelance, I wasn't a staff member then, I took jobs in hi-fi shops in Tottenham Court Road. That's what I really loved, my hi-fi and studios and things like that. So it was a good blend. And then I'd get a call from Henry Murray, and he would say, well, we've got some job for you. And often I would find my own jobs, because I would say, well, look, you know, if you look through the mailbags, you'll probably find complaints about such and such a company, because they're advertising big frequently in the small ads of the Evening Standard. And they said, sure enough. So I did roofing, building, textured coating walls, stone cladding, just about anything. Bogus hi-fi shops that were selling seconds and covering up the stamped on the box seconds with their own, you know, name and address. And the story just flowed through. And then Esther got pregnant. And then there was a very little of That's Life series. And so I thought, well, okay, I was single. I moved up to Newcastle for a few months to reconnect with the people on my first story, which was the insurance brokers. We decided to stay in contact. So I had two friends in Newcastle, and I lived there for 6 months, where I met another girl. And then I got the call, oh, we moved there, but do you want to come in? So I moved to London, got a flat in Stamford Hill, started working there. This was about 75, 76, when Esther had a baby, and she was having a bit of a rough time about it all. And I think there was magazine things about her having postnatal blues and that sort of thing. But anyway, went into Kensington House, and it was a much nicer office environment, whereas the previous Lime Grove was built into the upper floor of a row of houses. From the outside, it just looked like houses that people were living in, but it was actually the That's Life office. But Kensington House was a different ball game. It was based in the lower ground floor, which to normal people would be the basement, and at the far end of the corridor. And I met Janice Livermore, who was Esther Ranson's personal assistant, and Jane Wiley. And I said, look, I've got this upcoming story. I need to discuss it and see if we're going to make any go of it. And the girls were gossiping, and I couldn't type with toppy, two fingers, and if I was lucky. And Jane Wiley used to do the typing for me, or anyone else who was available. I used to just read off my research notes and then use the extract from the sales script. And during the gossipy times, Jane Wiley had just come off Jim Will Fix It. And she was saying to Janice Livermore, do you know Jimmy Savile, he's a real creep. Now, I know women aren't very direct, you know, they're sort of circumstance and a bit shy about making accusations. And so I said, what you mean, he likes the little boys and girls? And she nodded. And I said, well, that's bad. Do they know upstairs? And she said, no, they don't want to know. And this was in 76. It didn't blow up. And it blew up again a little bit a few years later on.
See, that's an interesting answer, Ian, isn't it? They don't want to know. Actually, what it means is they do know, but it's a bit of an inconvenient truth.
Exactly right. Absolutely. And I was beginning to learn more things, because having spent a couple of years freelancing at Lime Grove, Kensington House, I was used more. It was an open plan office, and
but I mean, I can almost imagine, you know, you coming up with a story about Savile for That's Life.
Well, that wasn't going to be, because I had an all over pass, which was arranged to me, and my money was arranged by a new editor, Peter Schaefer, who was one of the architects behind Crime Watch, and then that links into the Crime Watch. And I met one of the presenters, what's his name? Rob. I can't remember his name now, young fella. Anyway, he was in another. That's right.
Was there any hint at this time that there was any kind of police interest in Savile?
I wasn't aware of any. What I did was I went to Top of the Pops, and I started lurking around. I got obviously in because I had a BBC pass. I went to Telecentre, and the Top of the Pops had a dedicated studio. I was watching very quietly from afar, and I was asked what I was doing there, and I said, oh, I'm just looking to see how music is recorded and so on, you know. I'm freelance now in Ken House, and you know, I'd be interested in learning more about it before, you know, applying it. You know, that's what I said to one of the Top of the Pops people. And so anyway, I went to the bar. Jimmy Savile never drank, as far as I know. I never saw him in the bar or anywhere like that. But then there were whispers, and I saw his attitude, and I saw some of the production staff. And I thought, he is creepy, you know. And it's a word that I heard a second time, just by sheer coincidence, years later. Anyway, I went on, said nothing, did nothing, but a few things made my hairs on the back of my neck stand out. And that was, we were very thorough on my stories up to me having to go to Paris's offices in the Strand, who were retained by the BBC, obviously. And I've been questioned about a particular story. And I thought, well, this is very thorough. And they were going over points of law, because it's a grey area, door-to-door selling. You know, is it illegal? It's definitely immoral. It's cheating people out of huge interest rate loans to buy something that they never really wanted in the first place. The products in themselves were okay, except the fake springs in the orthopedic beds. But by and large, aluminium guttering, textured wall coatings, all these things were products, but the price they were asking and the amount of interest on there, it's only going to cost you the price of a newspaper a day, was the line. But you're getting someone in debt for 10 years, you know, that sort of thing, which I thought was immoral, but it wasn't illegal. But the one particular sticking point, the editor sent me to see the ballet, so we went through it all, and then we did go ahead. And a couple of times, people tried to take out High Court injunctions to prevent transmission. And we got it every time. Every time I wanted to set up a recording session, in those days we didn't have little cameras or anything, we just had great big clumpy radio transmitters and a BBC one, blank, no BBC on it. And with engineers inside with huge reel-to-reel recorders, and they'd pre-plan radio transmitters around the house to make secret recordings. Now, to do that, we needed permission from the General Director General of the BEEB. And in my time, there were three there, and don't ask me, Tony, I couldn't name them. I can look it up. But each time we got permission, and the recordings were non-transmittal, but it was basically evidence gathering. And we managed to record several jobs, as I call them. I managed to get them recorded, and then they were transcribed, and then it was actually included into the script. So in other words, the salesman had a written script, they had to learn it line by line, but we needed what was actually said. So basically, the sales pitch was transcribed, and then that was absolute proof.
Anyway, so, look, let's get back up to today. Can we get up to today? Because Esther was a very big figure, obviously, Saturday night, BBC, number one primetime programme, really. And in those days, there was genuine competition between the ITV and BBC to get the viewers in. And so you were straining at the bit, really, to produce the best television possible. Nowadays, obviously, it's almost the opposite. They seem to be trying their best to produce bland TV. Esther has reared her head again recently. She's become a big fan of this whole principle of assisted dying. Now, this seems to me to be almost the at complete antithesis of what that's life was about. I mean, there's even now organizations producing these illegal pods which will smother people and kill them with nitrogen. And so this is becoming like, it's almost like there's an industry growing up around killing people. Now, this doesn't seem like Esther Ranson to me, Ian.
No. I mean, I've got a couple of interesting things to say about that. But just pedal backwards to the beginning of COVID, or as it was really sad. Esther Ranson appeared on TV and she more or less, I can't remember the exact words, but it made me feel quite sick. If she's into the truth, and I was learning some truth about COVID because I became awake, and I thought, hang on a minute, she's calling people idiots for not having the jab. And I thought, but she's wants to tell the truth. And then it reminded me of the conversations in the That's Life office when I thought, well, about Jimmy Savile. Nothing was done about it. And then there was the other things, like I was extremely thorough and I never got the BBC into any trouble whatsoever. But some of the researchers were working on jobs and countless times there was headlines in the papers. The BBC make out-of-court settlements for an undisclosed sums. And these were huge. And I just stayed away from it. But I thought, how could he make such a blunder? There was somebody else did a story, and it was false. And the BBC was threatened to be sued. And then the BBC, who benefited from the money? So that rang alarm bells. Another thing that rang alarm bells was a conversation in the office at Ken House where a researcher called out to Esther and said, look, such and such a person needs help. And she retorted back, we don't help people, we're making a TV show. And that shook me because I thought I was doing the right and proper thing, exposing the con so that people know them. The modern day would be, you know, alerting people to scams. Well, this was these were scams. And then as when time went on, didn't see much of Esther. Desmond did his visit series. And then Esther did another one. I think it was Henry who did Time of Your Life. And then Esther did. Anyway, she was championing Childline and all the other stuff. And then, of course, my radar went up when Jill Dando was killed because it was a close relationship with Cliff Richard. And so I started thinking more about that. And I thought, hang on a minute. And then it transpired that I was learning more about Jimmy Savile, the accusations that were being made and so on, and going nowhere. Just like Ted Heath, lots of some investigation and it went nowhere. And for another occasion, Tony, I can tell you something about Ted Heath, which I heard from a witness who was not themselves affected by Ted Heath's habits. But on another occasion, I can tell you about Ted Heath. But I was looking at, I was working, I was away from the BBC, but I still was keeping my hand in. And I was using the principle of accept nothing, believe no one, and confirm everything. And I was doing a little bit of digging around, but I didn't have any power of like the law does. And I had no resources like a journalist like yourself has. But I thought I was tinkering around. And I thought it was very odd that Jill Dando died, and then she was making noises about Jimmy Savile and Cliff Richard. And I thought that was very odd. But I don't think we'll ever know what really happened.
That's Life was really included everybody.
We seem to be exposing a lot of Jewish people, and I didn't think anything of it at the time. And then Esther said to I was presenting a story, and Esther was looking at me, and then she said to Henry, "Are they one of us?" And I thought, that was a very odd thing to say. Who are you then? And then and that really stuck with me. And I thought, you know, we make TB programs. We're not here to help anybody. And the comment like, are they one of us? And I thought, well, who are you? And then,
what does it mean? What does it mean? Can you decipher that at all?
Well, all I can, with hindsight, I think, are they one of our Jews or are they some other Jew? And I started to think about it. And then the penny started dropping when I became aware of Zionism. And that's the only thing I could come up with. So that's life in itself, was making programs, not helping people. They were paying out-of-court judgments. They needed another That's Life to investigate That's Life, because it didn't sit right with me in the common sense. You know, we are told facts and we are asked to believe them. And I thought, if it's all bluster, childlike, we're helping people and so on. And I'm thinking, why the interest? It's like Netanyahu saying now, we care for human rights and so on, you know. And yet they're bombing the blitz out of people. And it's just like this mantra I'm hearing from pro-Zionists. And I'm thinking, they actually believe it. They're actually acting out. And I'm sensing that in retrospect, some of that within the BBC. You know, the reluctance to do anything about Jimmy Savile. I mean, if you want... You know, rumours about Cliff Richard. I don't think he was a serious paedophile. I think he accidentally fell into it because it turned out he was gay. I mean, they didn't like him to the public to know he was gay because he had a huge female following. But I always suspected there was something wrong, but I didn't have the means really to go and investigate any deeper. But it's an amazing world.
It's an interesting and amazing world that you fell into there, because television in the 1970s was really in its sort of heyday, the 60s and 70s. Obviously, they were trying to bring in loads of audience, and they were making sure everyone got a TV in their house. It's a very different kettle of fish today. But those youngsters brought up sort of since the 1990s, 2000s, looking at TV, many of them just don't bother because they don't see any point. And, you know, back That's in right. those days, it was a different story. Anyway, look, Ian, if people are interested in chatting with you, finding you, are you on social media, that sort of thing?
I suppose the best place to find me, I use my laptop instead of a mobile phone to run my life. You know, most people, and I hope I'm not upsetting you, but I've got a smartphone, an old one, which isn't all that smart. But I don't use social media on my mobile phone, don't do banking, don't tap in. I just use a basic card and cash where I can. So everything is based at home. And the most I use is Ian Hilpus, H-I-L-P for Peter, U-S, on Facebook.
Ian Hilpus, thanks very much for joining us.
You're welcome.